From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation. I'm Marty Moscoane. High prices and food shortages are part of the daily struggle in the former Soviet Union, struggles that go with making the transition from communism to capitalism. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with journalist Hedrick Smith about what he saw on his recent trip there. He's got a new frontline documentary, After Gorbachev's USSR, which airs this week. Also, writer Robert Olin Butler spent time in Vietnam, but he doesn't write your typical war story. His latest book is a collection of short stories called A Good Scent from a Strange Mountain. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews three new CBS programs which premiered this week. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. General Motors announced today it lost $4.5 billion in 1991. The company says it's closing 12 plants. Don Gagne reports.
During 1991, GM and every other automaker trying to sell cars in the U.S. was battered by war, recession, and growing competition in the market. Sean McAlinden is an analyst from the University of Michigan.
Well, this is the worst year in U.S. motor vehicle history when the supplier losses are all known. We expect it to rise beyond $11 billion for the industry. And there is reason to believe the Japanese at the same time last year lost $4 billion in the U.S.-Canadian market.
During a nationwide closed-circuit telecast to workers, GM Chairman Robert Stempel today ended a competition between plants in Willow Run, Michigan and Arlington, Texas. Willow Run will close, Arlington stays open. 11 other plants will shut down, some as early as this year, in Michigan, Ohio, Indiana, New York and Ontario. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
Secretary of State James Baker told Congress today that he's demanding a total freeze on Israeli settlements in the occupied territories as a condition for U.S. loan guarantees. Israel wants the United States to back $10 billion in loans to provide jobs and housing for Soviet immigrants. Baker told a House Appropriations Subcommittee that he offered Israel two alternatives. If Israel halts all settlement activity, including road building and other infrastructure, it can have the $10 billion in guarantees over 5 years. If Israel chooses to complete the houses already under construction in the occupied territories, the money spent on those houses would be deducted from the loan guarantees. The Irish Supreme Court started hearing arguments today in the case of a 14-year-old who's been barred from leaving the country for an abortion. The girl allegedly became pregnant after being raped by a family friend. From London, NPR's Michael Sullivan reports.
The girl flew to England for an abortion 2 weeks ago, but returned without having one after the Irish Attorney General issued an injunction preventing her from traveling abroad for 9 months. That decision was upheld by the High Court last Monday. Her lawyers are expected to argue that the lower court ruling violates the girl's right to free travel guaranteed by the Irish Constitution and European Community law. A decision is expected by Friday. In 1983, the Irish people voted by a 2-to-1 margin to change the Constitution to ban all abortions except when the mother's life is in danger. But this particular case has brought a dramatic change in public opinion. In a poll conducted for Dublin's Independent on Sunday newspaper, 2/3 of those surveyed said the amendment should be changed to allow abortion in specific circumstances such as this one. Should the court reject the family's appeal, another referendum on the issue is likely. I'm Michael Sullivan in London.
Stock prices closed today with little change after a session of mixed trading on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 2 points to close at 3,282.42. This is NPR News. South African President F.W. de Klerk set a date today for the whites-only referendum that will test the acceptance of his proposed constitutional reforms. The question to be put to white voters is whether or not they support the negotiating process aimed at producing a new non-racial constitution. De Klerk has said that if he loses, he'll resign and call a whites-only election that could bring the pro-apartheid Conservative Party to power. He said today that the date for the referendum will be March 17th. The French Minister of Transport said today that he's ordering the Airbus consortium to change part of its cockpit design on the Airbus A320 in order to improve safety. This decision follows publication of an interim report on the crash of an Airbus A320 in France last month that killed 87 people on board. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
Transport Minister Paul Quillet said Airbus must come up with a plan to change the design of the paneling which pilots use to program the plane's descent. There are two different options, and pilots say that on the A320, it's easy to confuse them. It's not yet known, however, if this was the cause of the accident. The interim report published today only lays out the circumstances leading up to the crash. It does not draw any conclusions. Yet based on its findings, the transport minister also decided to make it mandatory that all French planes are equipped with a warning that tells the pilots when their plane is approaching the ground too quickly. This warning system is mandatory on most planes worldwide, but Air Antares, the company which owned the plane that crashed, did not install the device in its A320s. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
The federal spending deficit was up sharply in January, pushed up by the money spent for the savings and loan bailout. The Treasury Department said today that the deficit rose to $15.7 billion in January. That brings the spending gap for the first quarter of the fiscal year to almost $99 billion. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Back in the early 70s, when the Cold War was very much alive, Hedrick Smith was in the thick of the conflict, reporting from the Soviet Union for the New York Times. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his coverage and wrote the best-selling book, The Russians. 2 years ago, Smith went back to a changed Soviet Union to document how Gorbachev's reforms were affecting people's lives. He took a film crew and hosted a four-part series on Frontline called Inside Gorbachev's USSR. Last month, Smith returned to Russia and looked up the same people he had filmed 2 years ago to see how their lives had changed amidst the political and economic upheavals. His new documentary, After Gorbachev's USSR, will be broadcast on the PBS series Frontline this Tuesday. Smith found that the breakup of the Republic and Yeltsin's lifting of price controls has created shortages and uncertainty. I asked him how people were coping.
With enormous difficulty, with a lot of complaining, and just simply enduring a battle for survival. At the personal level, I mean, I found people who'd literally waited in line 4 hours to buy a couple of loaves of bread. At the industrial level, I found major industrial companies where the managers said they were cut off by some of their suppliers because of the breakup of the Soviet Union, a Russian enterprise with 29 Ukrainian suppliers getting nothing from the Ukraine because of the fight between Boris Yeltsin, the president of Russia, and Leonid Kravchuk, the president of Ukraine. So disruption almost everywhere, but a few signs here and there of things developing. The first commodity exchanges, actually the ticker tape showing in one stock exchange, commodity exchange, unusual. Big change from a couple of years ago. Private farmers beginning to appear, having their own herds of livestock. So some counter trends, but the overwhelming impression is one of enormous difficulty. As Yeltsin said to the people when he started this period of reform, these will be the hardest months since Russia emerged from World War II. And a lot of Russians find it that way.
Who calls themselves then communists in Russia today?
Almost nobody does. Everybody wants to be, that's not true, everybody, but the great majority of people want to be thought of as new Russians, as new thinkers, as reformers. I mean, people who have no idea what the market economy is like and who abhor many of its characteristics and fear the uncertainties involved in trusting the law of supply and demand will nonetheless say they're for a market. Almost everybody says they're for a democracy. There are more and more people, however, who are saying this winter that democracy and market economics bring chaos, bring high prices, bring poverty, and are going to bring unemployment and so forth. Therefore, we need to turn back towards firm rule, towards a tough boss at the top, towards the kind of firm hand that Russians are used to. Very few of them will say what we need is restoration of communism. But what they do say is we need the strong central hand at the top, and that's almost synonymous with communism to a lot of them.
You mentioned Russian President Boris Yeltsin's lifting of price controls. Can you tell us what then the sort of personal effect that that is having on people's lives? And I guess we can focus in the beginning on people living in cities like Moscow.
Well, it doesn't matter whether you're in Moscow or in provincial cities like Ivanovo or Yaroslavl or Novgorod, in central Russia or in western Russia. What happened was literally overnight, the price of bread tripled. The price of milk in Yaroslavl, where I went up from 60 kopecks to 6 rubles, 80 kopecks to 6 rubles 40 overnight. Never mind what the exchange rate is. Overnight, it went up eightfold. So it's an enormous jolt to people. The expectation of Yeltsin and company is that a lot of people will not pay those prices, and that the producers, in order to market their goods, are gradually going to have to lower the prices. But what they're up against is the old wholesale cartels that existed in the Soviet system. There was, in Moscow, there was a central milk distribution agency. There's a central bakery. There's a central dairy products wholesale trading agency. And it's a monopoly. And even though you've gotten rid of the price controls, that monopoly or those monopolies out in the provinces can decide what to charge. And in a way, you don't have a free market system. So what Yeltsin is hoping to do is to jar those people so hard that they're going to have to figure out a better market strategy, lower the prices, and gradually things will get more normalized. But it's a very painful process to go through.
Well, are you then suggesting that people are starving? Is malnutrition a real threat to the Russian people?
I don't think people are starving. We haven't seen any evidence of death by famine. But there's no question that the older people who are living on fixed pensions, who have no outside earning power, are really in very bad shape. The outside food aid that is coming in primarily from Western Europe, but also to some degree from the United States, is very important to keep these people going. Many of them are showing up in the new Russian equivalent of soup kitchens, depending to some degree on charity to keep them going. And I think Yeltsin is under a great deal of pressure to increase their pensions. Outright starvation, not yet, but pretty different. These people are living on bread and very watery soup, very meager rations, just as they lived after World War II.
I'm speaking with Hedrick Smith, and he's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. And just recently, he visited the Soviet Union and looking at the reform of that country. And his documentary will appear on this week's Frontline, which is a PBS documentary series. You visited in the countryside and went to visit a number of farmers. And it appears, certainly the way you present it in your documentary, that there's just about a war going on between state-owned farms and private farmers.
Well, there is, except that it's a very unequal war. The state farmers have all the resources. They have the machinery of the state behind them. They have the workers, and they have a lien on the state credit system. So it's very difficult for private farmers. There are probably in Russia only about 40,000 private farmers all told, and there's several million people working on the state and collective farms. So it's an uneven struggle. What's going on is that there are a few hardy souls who say, I can do better on my own. I want to raise my own cattle or sheep or pigs or grain or whatever it is, and they try to go out on their own. They then have an enormous problem getting tractors, equipment, fertilizer, marketing their products once they get done. The present situation of shortages helps them a bit. I did meet one farmer, Alexander Yozhikov, whom you'll see, and he has just made, just before my arrival, a big deal with a local factory to sell meat and milk to that factory. So he is helped by that. On the other hand, he's desperate for feed grain to keep his cows producing milk during the wintertime, and the whole state distribution system is tilted towards the state farms, and he can't get a hold of it. I'm there on his farm with a state farmer who's got lots of grain. He wants to buy some grain from the state farmer, and the state farmer doesn't want to help him. So there is a great sense of rivalry. The state farm director is afraid that if Yozhikov, the private farmer, succeeds, that many of his own farm workers will decide to go the same way, and he will lose his state farm, his power, his prestige, his privileges, his job. So he's fighting it.
You say there are just about 40,000 private farmers. What do you think they have in common, or what do you think it is that makes them so determined to be private farmers in a system that's really, even at this point, working against them?
I don't know. Guts. It's very striking. These are very unusual people. I asked Yozhikov what it took. He said working about 15 or 16 hours a day and self-confidence. And I said, so where did you get the self-confidence? He said, yeah, Neftchanikom bil. I was an oil driller. up in the north. He said, do you know what it takes to drill oil in Siberia? He said, that's what it takes. And so, I mean, I think it does take that kind of determination, because you have to buck not only the elements and all the problems that farmers all over the world face, but you have to fight a system which is still in the hands of people that prefer a socialist state-oriented system.
Well, do they call themselves capitalists? Is that literally how they think it, or is it just that this is a matter of their own survival?
Well, there's a different term in Russia. It's the term is chastniki, which means kind of privatizers. It's the equivalent of capitalists. They don't use the word capitalist, but no, they think of themselves as individual entrepreneurs, as do the people who are operating in the private sector. And there are about 7 million people in the small trade, small business, medium-sized business, private sector of the Russian economy now. So it's growing. But this is still a very small minority of the people.
Is capitalism considered an American word?
Sometimes. It's certainly a Western word, and to some people it's good, and to an awful lot of people it's still a bad word. I mean, the market is a good word. Market means sort of more goods, a little bit more competition, and somehow it's not connected with any of the downside, with unemployment, with businesses failing, or, you know, with high prices or anything like that. Capitalism is still, in a lot of Russians' minds, a word that implies speculation and somehow creaming an either illegal or improper profit off goods, exploiting other people, either your workers or the customers. So it still isn't yet a good word. People use other words even when they're in favor of moving in that direction.
I'm speaking with Hendrik Smith, and he's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, television documentary correspondent, and also the author of a number of books about the Russians. And his latest book, The New Russians, is just now out in paperback. He just returned from Russia, where he was working on a documentary for Frontline. It will air this week on Frontline series, and it's called After Gorbachev's USSR. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with journalist Hendrik Smith, and we're talking about Russia. He just returned from a visit there and a visit for a documentary, which will appear on the Frontline series this week. One of the workers that you spoke to said, we used to work for the party government, and he named several other sort of institutions, but we don't know who we're working for now. Is that part of the problem, you think, is that sort of the Russian people just not having a sense of who they're working for and what that all means?
The really biggest difficulty in perestroika, in restructuring that society, is not the building of new institutions. It is changing people's mindsets. It's their psychology. Russians are historically used to having a strong central government, focusing on the leadership, getting orders from above, and having a sense that they work for, if not the state under the communist system, then Russia under the old czarist system. And the czar and the governor and the whole structure of the Russian government before the communist system was very strong in their minds. Now, as they said, and as you quoted, they're suddenly given freedom. Yeltsin has gone further than Gorbachev in trying to break up the centralized power, to free things up, to have more pluralism, more competition. And these people are baffled by it all. As you said, they say, who are we working for now? And you answer, we're supposed to be working for yourselves. And their answer is, well, how does that work? I mean, somebody's got to give the orders here. Somebody's got to run the factory. And they haven't gotten to the point yet of having stockholders. But if they do, and you talk to them about that, they say, who are the stockholders? It's such a foreign notion, the whole way that capitalism operates, that It's going to take quite a while for people's minds to change so that they can understand it, first of all, but then trust it.
Well, it's also a system, you say, that's not working yet. So even then, to work within the system, it seems to me, at least certainly the way you painted in your documentary, they're not getting any returns for it.
That's right. The Russian leadership didn't do what the Chinese leadership did back over a decade ago, which was to give the people in the countryside more and more land they could work for themselves and an incentive of money to make more and grow more and then send more of their food to the cities. What happened in a very simple way for the Chinese peasantry and then for the city dwellers is they could understand that if you change to a slightly freer economic system, there would be benefits for everybody. The Chinese leadership built a constituency for that kind of economic reform. Gorbachev didn't do that. Now, Yeltsin has come along, and he's in an absolute crisis situation. He's got to change things. He doesn't have the time to do this. I think this will happen. I think in 2 or 3 years, you're going to see the same kind of thing happening in the countryside in Russia as you saw in China. But we're now at the very, very early stages of it, and Russians can't see results. So naturally, they're skeptical and afraid.
Well, I wonder, too, how just the issue of scarcity plays into people's mindset. It's very difficult to think either long-term or to think beyond your own specific needs if you feel like there isn't enough to go around.
Absolutely. An awful lot of people who are for reform in principle have given up on it this winter simply in the struggle for survival. One of the striking things that I found was the generational differences. If you talk to older people, people over 60, over 55, they were angry. They felt abandoned. They felt as though not only were they suffering from low pensions and shortages, but that their whole lives had been called into question. The new leadership, the new philosophy, the new thinking, the new Russians were telling them, look, everything you did was sort of in vain and stupid, and you were a tool of Stalin and Brezhnev and Khrushchev and company. And they are fed up and discouraged. If you go to the other end, you go to people under 35, they have some hope for the future. They say, all right, it's worth making some sacrifices now to make things better. You find more people in that age group in the private sector attempting new things, willing to experiment, not so locked into the old system. And then you find, you know, the great bulk of the population between 35 and 60 kind of swinging with the winds. If things are working, well, they're for it. If things aren't working, then they're against it. And right now, they're against reform. They've given up because the practical results are so difficult for them personally.
Would you say, then, this winter was the real test for the Russian people and the Russian government?
I think this winter and next winter. If next winter is, you know, they're getting close to finishing this winter. And Russian psychological moods do change with the seasons. When the weather gets warmer, you can go outside, you start your spring planning, that kind of stuff. There is a kind of a lifting of the spirits over there. So by mid-April, they'll be feeling better. But if next winter is like this winter, I'm not sure that the experiment will survive at least that winter. There'll be a swing back to the right. This is a time of testing right now for them and, for that matter, for the West and whether or not we're going to help.
What are some of the bright signs you see in Russia?
Well, what struck me and what was interesting for me personally was to go back and see old friends whom I knew and to follow the timelines of their personal lives and to see what had happened. Because when you look at the situation in general, it's pretty dark. I mean, you see the hunger, you see the high prices, you see the demonstrations of people are unhappy. But when you go into people's lives and you see four women, for example, in one city, where they'd had a hunger strike 2.5 years ago in order to try to reopen the church and that Stalin had closed in their city and there was only one functioning church in their city. You go back to that city, as I did, and you find that there are now four functioning churches. The church where there was a hunger strike, there are 1,500 people attending Mass, and the women aren't even there because they've gone on and they've opened up two more churches. That's a big change. When you go to a city like Novgorod, where I met a man named Mark Masarsky, who was a small entrepreneur when I met him 2.5, 3 years ago, he'd taken an old prison, converted it into a brick factory. I go back this time, he's got a small commercial empire. You know, he's got joint ventures with Austrians and Swiss and Yugoslavs. He's a partner in a bank. He's got several other enterprises. He's got a scheme now to to go mine gold and to help the country as well as helping himself. I mean, big change in his life. You go into the countryside 2.5, 3 years ago, you practically couldn't find any private farmers. Now you find a few, not many, but you find some, and they're surviving somehow. Even when you go to a huge factory like Uralmash, in what used to be called Sverdlovsk, now called Yekaterinburg, a throwback to the old Russian past, you find the directors there complaining terribly about all the disruptions of the breakup of the Soviet Union, of not getting supplies, of having to barter and everything. But you find them grudgingly readjusting to the new economic situation, making changes. There are new commodity exchanges where they can buy some of their supplies. So there are these changes, but they're rather subtle. They haven't built a momentum yet. But there are things that are going on that show positive trends, positive undercurrents beneath this kind of surface whipping up of the waves of suffering this winter over the economic situation.
What do you think the United States should do to help the Russian people?
Well, I think there are probably two things, and we've really focused only on one of them. I think the first thing that needs to be done by the West as a whole, and by the way, the Europeans are much more prepared to do this than we are. We're the ones who are dragging our feet, so it's not as if we're way out front. First thing we got to do is help them stabilize the value of their currency. One of the reasons why there's so much economic uncertainty, why goods aren't coming to the market, why people aren't doing business, is they don't know what the money is worth. And an economic international economic stabilization fund is enormously important. But much more important than that over the long run is what I would call human aid, talent aid, a large Peace Corps, an executive service corps, a pensioners corps, lots of Americans going to Russia or Ukraine or other places to help teach them how to run city government, how to run their businesses, how to set up businesses, and vice versa. A lot of those people coming over here. The way you build the infrastructure of democracy in a market economy is basically by the transfer of human knowledge. Now, in some cases, they've got, for example, very talented, well-organized people in the old military-industrial complex. We need to help channel that into peaceful production before it comes back to haunt us again.
Do you think that the old system, the old communist system, has really collapsed? And do you think that the coup of August was really the last gasp of that old system?
Well, I think it was the last gap of the old system in the sense of a power struggle to try to restore the old system. But your other question about whether or not the old system has collapsed is a very good one. What I wrote in The New Russians was that it was decapitated. The old system was decapitated. Its head was cut off by the failure of the coup. The command center in Moscow was cut. But that the body, the arms, the legs, all the tentacles of the old system remain out in the countryside and even in the city of Moscow, particularly in the economy. I think this is what Yeltsin is trying to break up. This is something I think that is very difficult for outsiders to understand. We tend to look at Russian politics, Soviet politics, in black or white, either or. Either the reformers are in power or the old guard is in power. But the situation's much more mixed than that. Yeltsin and the reformers are in power at the center. But in fact, there are a lot of the old people who are still sitting there in their old jobs all over the country, and they are great obstacles to progress. That's the people who the private farmers, the private entrepreneurs, the new younger people are fighting against. The new Russians are still fighting against the old Russians who are still there.
There was one farmer that you met with, and he owned one of the big state-supported farms. And one of the things you did was to take a bath together or to jump into a pool together.
Yeah.
That's called a banya?
A banya. It's the old Russian banya. It's a whole ritual. What you do is you get in the Russian equivalent of a sauna, except they love to throw either water or beer on the rocks, and then they get the branches of birch leaves and they beat each other in order to bring your blood to the surface. They think it purifies you, and then you go plunge into the cold water in the pool, or you take a cold shower, and then get back out and do it again. And that's typical in that part of the world. Finns do it, Swedes do it, but the Russians do it in a kind of more earthy way. And that's just part of mixing in and getting into their culture. It's a lot of fun.
Well, it was great to see two men with towels sort of talking about the world.
Well, I guess that's what the Romans used to do.
Right. Well, Hedrick Smith, thank you so much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
It was my pleasure.
Hedrick Smith is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He recently visited Russia to make a documentary for the PBS Frontline series. The documentary is called After Gorbachev's USSR, and it airs this Tuesday. I'm Marty Moskowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Artie Moss-Cohen with Fresh Air. Like many Americans, writer Robert Olin Butler served in Vietnam, but his memories aren't of combat. They're of wandering the back streets of Saigon, meeting the people, and immersing himself in their culture. Coming up, we reminisce with Robert Olin Butler. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews three new CBS series, Scorch, Fish Police, and The Boys of Twilight. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Secretary of State James Baker says that the U.S. will not offer new loan guarantees to Israel unless it agrees to stop settlements in the occupied territories. This announcement came as the fourth round of Middle Eastern peace talks resumed in Washington. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
The talks started up again today after 10 days of violence in the Middle East. Palestinian spokeswoman Hanana Shrawi said that the clashes underscore the urgency of reaching a peace agreement. She also said the current round of talks must deal with substantive issues. One of those issues is Jewish settlements in the Israeli-occupied territories. Secretary of State James Baker today said the United States will reject Israel's request for loan guarantees to settle Soviet Jews if Israel continues to build. Arab delegates in Washington welcomed Baker's statement. But Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir said Israel will not accept the diktat of the United States. Israeli Housing Minister Ariel Sharon today said that 22,000 units are under construction in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. I'm Linda Gradstein in Washington.
General Motors has announced that it had net losses last year of $4.5 billion and plans to close 12 plants, affecting more than 16,000 workers. On Capitol Hill, the chairman of the powerful House Energy and Commerce Committee, John Dingell, reacted to the news. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
General Motors plans to close the Willow Run Assembly Plant in Ypsilanti, Michigan, and the Flint, Michigan V8 engine plant, putting thousands out of work. Michigan Democrat John Dingell says he blames Japan's unfair trade practices and the White House, which Dingell says did nothing to stop them.
I am a free trader. I am a believer in free trade. But my mother raised no idiots. I do not believe in the idea that we should permit them to do unto us that which is clearly improper, and to try then to compete.
There's not much Dingell can do about GM's poor performance or the poor showing of the other two big three auto companies. This was the worst year in the history of the American auto industry. Ford posted a loss of $2.26 billion this year. Chrysler lost $795 million. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
In Moscow, former East German leader Erich Honecker has been hospitalized. A government official said that Honecker would be allowed to return to Chile's embassy after his medical treatment. But if he tried to leave the country, the government might intervene. Honecker is wanted in Germany on charges of manslaughter for ordering the shooting of people who tried to flee East Germany. He has a daughter who lives in Chile, and the government there has said he would be accepted. Honecker is said to be suffering from cancer. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 2 points to close at 3,282.42 in very active trading. This is NPR News. In an 8-1 ruling, the U.S. Supreme Court has refused to stop the government from continuing to send home Haitian boat people. More than 5,400 Haitians have already been returned, and another 8,500 are housed at a U.S. naval base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. This week, Congress will consider legislation to temporarily stop the movement. Democratic leaders in the House have scheduled a vote Wednesday on a measure to impose a 6-month ban on forced returns. Less than 1 week before a vote in Bosnia over whether to leave the Yugoslav Federation, a bitter dispute has broken out over the future of the Federal Army in the region. The majority, Muslim and Croatian communities, want the army out, a move that is opposed by ethnic Serbs. Pierre Vickery reports from Zagreb.
Politicians representing Bosnia's Muslim and Croatian communities say the Yugoslav army will have to withdraw if voters choose independence at the referendum this weekend. If the Serbian-led federal forces refuse to leave, Bosnia would consider them an army of occupation. But representatives of Bosnia's large Serbian minority say they will not countenance independence, let alone a military pullout. The comments come despite an agreement negotiated in the Portuguese capital Lisbon over the weekend, at which Serbian political leaders agreed to accept Bosnian independence in return for a large degree of local autonomy. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
In Washington, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that a Swiss bank cannot withhold information from U.S. officials looking into alleged tax violations. The High Court, without comment, let stand a ruling that the bank must provide investigators with account records from its branch in Panama, even though this violates Panamanian law. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Writer Robert Olin Butler has a linguist's ear for language. He served in Vietnam during the war, first in military intelligence and later as an interpreter for the American advisor to the mayor of Saigon. Since returning from the war in 1972, Butler has written a number of novels about war. These are intimate stories about the war's effect on people's most personal feelings and relationships. James Lee Burke wrote, "Robert Olin Butler is a poet who writes prose fiction. But more important is the beauty he saw rise from a tragic war. There is no American writer I know of who writes with more compassion and understanding than he." There is no American writer I know of who writes with more compassion and understanding than he. Butler lives in Louisiana now, where he teaches writing at McNeese State University. His latest book is a collection of short stories called A Good Scent from a Strange Mountain. Each of these stories is told by a Vietnamese expatriate living in America. I asked Butler to read the title story about a man's dream of being visited by Ho Chi Minh in the middle of the night. Only in this story, Ho is a pastry chef.
Ho Chi Minh came to me again last night, his hands covered with confectioner's sugar. This was something of a surprise to me, the first time I saw him beside my bed, in the dim light from the open shade. My oldest daughter leaves my shades open, I think so that I will not forget that the sun has risen again in the morning. I am a very old man. She seems to expect that one morning I will simply forget to keep living. This is very foolish. I will one night rise up from my bed and slip into her room and open the shade there. Let her see the sun in the morning. She is 64 years old, and she should worry for herself. I could never die from forgetting. But the light from the street was enough to let me recognize Ho when I woke, and he said to me, "Dao, my old friend, I have heard it is time to visit you." Already on that first night, there was a sweet smell about him, very strong in the dark, even before I could see his hands. I said nothing, but I stretched to the nightstand beside me and I turned on the light to see if he would go away, and he did not.
How did you find the voice of a 100-year-old man?
That's a good question and a fundamental question, and it's the, I don't know, you know, the 15 voices in this book are all radically different and range from a 17-year-old half Vietnamese, half American, girl to a 45-year-old Vietnamese woman, to this man, to all over. And they were all, it was a very odd experience. I don't know where those voices came from, except my deep involvement with the Vietnamese people when I was in Vietnam and as much as I could stay involved with them since then. And when I went to my computer every day, it was almost like automatic writing. I mean, I would open myself up to all of that, and some voice would choose to speak, and I was as astonished and as delighted and as anyone else when I heard these voices coming.
Well, it's interesting to me that you were a playwright before you went to Vietnam, but mm-hmm. you returned to write novels.
That's right.
Do you know what happened in Vietnam to turn you into a novelist?
Yes, certainly. A novelist, fiction writing, is deeply embedded for the creator of fiction in the senses. And as a playwright, one's working in a collaborative art, and most of the sensual things. A playwright creates structure and words, the words of characters. And you know, and their actions, but that whole rich, textured encounter with the sensual, moment-to-moment experience of life—that's left to other artists in the theater, the actors themselves, the director, the production designers, and so forth. And I realized, going to Vietnam with the ravishing sensual experience of that year. That my own art must include those elements in my act of creation, which it did not in the theater.
You served in Vietnam in 1971.
Right.
You were a linguist there, an army linguist. Mm-hmm. Did you end up going then where soldiers didn't go?
Oh, yes. The first 5 months, I worked in military intelligence out in the 20, 25 miles northeast of Saigon, and then had a chance to get out into the countryside a lot. I worked with the Australians down in Phuc Thuy province, got into Vung Tau, but our unit stood down in 71. And I transferred and spent my last 7 months working as an administrative assistant to the American Foreign Service officer, who was the advisor to the mayor of Saigon. And I worked in a kind of civilian clothes job in Saigon City Hall, did a lot of odd jobs. And my deepest pleasure was virtually every night to go out in the middle of the night, 1 a.m, 2 a.m, and just wander the back alleys of Saigon, and crouch with people in their doorways. The city always seemed to be awake, and in the kind of the murky darkness of these back alleys, I would talk to people, and they'd invite me into their homes. And the Vietnamese are extraordinarily warm and welcoming and forgiving people, and I had very close relationships with dozens and dozens of Vietnamese of all kinds.
You've written a number of books about Vietnam. There's certainly references in your latest mm-hmm. book of stories and a couple of novels.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm comparing those really to the war novels that have been written about Vietnam. What do you think those combat novels missed that you were able to see?
Well, couple of things. The combat novel, the technology changes, the place names change, the mode of a soldier's finding some sort of chemical release changes, perhaps moving from alcohol to drugs or whatever. But underneath it all, a combat novel about Vietnam is going to bear a great resemblance down on its deeper artistic levels to a combat novel about World War II or about the Civil War or about the Peloponnesian Wars. There's certain ranges of human experience that opens up to exploration. And it's different from the sorts of things that I write about, which involves the clash of cultures, the nature of human kinship and connection, qualities of nature of love and of foreignness, which are matters that perhaps are not really exclusive to even a wartime situation necessarily.
Well, I want to talk some more, but I want to take a short break first. And I'm speaking today with Robert Olin Butler, and he's written a number of novels and has a new book. It's a collection of stories called A Good Scent from a Strange Mountain. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with writer Robert Olin Butler. You said in an interview that I read that the war was more about the clash of cultures than about the fighting, which for you, as you described it, went on in the background, went on in the horizon. And even as I read that, I guess I saw in the foreground GIs and Vietnamese people crossing and trying to deal with each other, and in the background, you know, literally bombs going off.
That's true. And actually, statistically, of fewer than, I think it's around 18% or less of the people who went to Vietnam ever saw any combat. Well over 80% of the Americans who went to Vietnam did not really see combat, but all of them encountered the culture in one way or another, to open themselves up to part of it, or to resist part of it, or to resist all of it, or to be overwhelmed by it. We are all products deeply of our culture, and our sense of what is close to us, and our sense of what is alien, our sense of our roots, and our sense of others' roots, and our sense of how to encounter human differences that on the surface seem great, but deep down are not. All of those issues, I think, are terribly important, and everyone who went to Vietnam was shaped by that.
You were certainly at a distinct advantage in that you knew the language. Do you think even just knowing the words got you that much closer than to appreciating the culture?
Of course. To learn a language is to rename the world, and to be in Vietnam and know the way the world is named there. I mean, just on a linguistic level, it opens you up. I saw things I could not have seen, even just moving through the landscape, if it weren't for this gift of language, which I was unexpectedly given.
Let me ask you a little bit about your writing.
Mm-hmm.
And early on in your writing career, you did a lot riding on trains, literally commuting from here to there. Is that true in any way still?
Not now. I it's true that my first four published novels were written on a lap board on the Long Island Railroad as I commuted from Seacliff, New York, into Manhattan to work a newspaper job. But for a little over 6 years now, I've been teaching creative writing at McNeese State University in Lake Charles, and so conditions are quite different and much improved. Though it was odd, there was a thing the psychologists call functional fixedness, that a certain task, if that's all you do in a certain place, you become such strong associations with that place that it facilitates the task. So what seemed like a horrible burden of writing on my lap on the train, and it was for a while, eventually that became part of the whole process. And I found, in fact, when I got to Lake Charles and off the train and in this new job, that I was afraid I would have to attach a little electric motor to my writing chair and jiggle it and hire somebody to come in and flap newspapers in my face. But no, I've adjusted, and so I now have a lovely writing space, and I can write standing still.
You've written a number of novels, many of them having to do with Vietnam, or as in the case of this this new book of stories, having to do with the Vietnamese community in this country. Is this a theme you're going to carry, you think, through your writing life?
I don't know. Of my six novels, three of them have nothing to do with Vietnam. The novel I'm working on now is not a Vietnam novel, though the character has been to Vietnam, and there are certain brief sort of connections of memory and so forth. The Vietnam experience of it is not the way people think about it. I was on a panel in Washington a few years ago, and people asked, what do you think about being a Vietnam novelist? And my answer was that an artist who must recoil from that, and I do, in the same way as if you would call Monet a lily pad painter. Vietnam is simply a metaphor, a body of experience, a backdrop, an instigator of action, a propeller of character, and there are many other things in my life as well. In America, grew up in a steel mill town in the St. Louis area in the Mississippi River bottoms. I've lived in a lot of places. I've known a lot of people and had a lot of different kinds of relationships. And Vietnam is just one part of my myself as a vehicle for that deeply connected sensual encounter with the world, which is what artists draw from. And so it will be there, but I don't want to ever be identified with it as such.
Well, it sounds like you're also not haunted the way many who fought in that war are haunted by the war.
That's true. I'm not. And although in a sense I am, I've just been able to turn it into art. My own belief is that many of the people who are haunted by the war are not haunted by the horrible memories and the killing and the fear. People are resilient and they get over those things pretty readily. My own conviction is that many of my fellow Vietnam veterans who are haunted by the war are haunted by the fact that that was the only year in their lives when they had a kind of cosmic consciousness, that every day you wake up in a situation that is foreign, that's alien, that's intense, that your life might be at risk, and suddenly everything, and I go back to the senses again, the sunsets are never quite the same, or the love of a woman, or a shower, or a pair of clean socks, or a good meal. Those things suddenly have an intensity, an ongoing intensity. Everything does because of that extraordinary circumstance that you're in. And I think a lot of Vietnam veterans are haunted by blandness and not horror. And in that sense, I am haunted in the same way. But by the intensity, the extraordinary intensity of that year, but it energizes my art, and so I don't have the psychic difficulties that others have with that.
Well, I thank you very much, Robert Olin Butler, for joining us today.
Thank you, Marty.
Robert Olin Butler's latest book is a collection of short stories called A Good Scent from a Strange Mountain. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Linda Wertheimer has joined us to tell us about today's show. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Marty. We're leading the program with the General Motors decision to identify several of the plants to be closed in future, including the Willow Run plant in Michigan. We'll have several points of view about that, a story on chief executive officers of American corporations, why they make so much money, and are they worth it? Several pieces on Israeli politics and U.S. loan guarantees, more on the republics of the former Soviet Union, this time it's Tajikistan, and on American politics, our citizen commentator talking about the main caucuses, and we'll ask the question, why are all these candidates white guys?
Thanks, Linda. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. If you watch the Olympics on CBS for any length of time, chances are you saw the promos for some or all of the new CBS series premiering this week, Scorch and Fish Police on Friday and The Boys of Twilight on Saturday. TV critic David Biancooley saw the promos and has seen preview tapes of the shows.
Let's do the worst first. Scorch is the show where a tiny talking dragon, actually a puppet, ends up living with an actor and his young daughter. In the episode I saw, the dragon and the guy get hired by a local TV station to do the weather, as a ventriloquist and his dummy. But CBS has taken the pilot back to have it reworked, so the final version and plot will be unavailable for preview. I can say this, though. When you're dealing with this kind of toxic waste, no amount of reworking will turn it into something good. Scorch is nothing but a ripoff of Alf with a dragon instead of an alien. And who needs another Alf in the first place? Now, Fish Police is a cartoon series that's based on a comic book, like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, only underwater. John Ritter is the voice of Inspector Gill, and other voices are provided by such noteworthy performers as Ed Asner, Tim Curry, Buddy Hackett, and Jonathan Winters. So the vocal talent is there. but the scriptwriting talent isn't. The animation is lousy and unimaginative, the jokes are one long stream of fishy puns, and the program tries to appeal to adults by adding some Roger Rabbit-style dialogue and characters. But it just doesn't work. Here's Ritter's Inspector Gill talking to a sexy fish played by Jo Beth Williams.
Gil, I may have a voice husky enough to pull a dog sled, but I didn't kill clams, I swear it.
Is this a snow job, Angel?
I thought we were friends.
We are, but I can't help you if you tie my fins.
You used to like that.
She's kidding.
No, she's not bad. She's just drawn that way. All of Fish Police seems begged, borrowed, or stolen from somewhere else, and there's a temptation to say it stinks. But by the time I was through watching one episode, even I was tired of fish puns. The Boys of Twilight, the only new show of the three worth sampling, is also a heavy borrower. It's set in a small mountain town like Northern Exposure, and all the characters are charming and eccentric. What's more, the premiere episode is built around the murder of a beautiful young girl, like Laura Palmer from Twin Peaks. There's a lot about this show that's too pat. The hokey music under every comic scene, the running gags that won't stop running, the blatant attempts to out-cute Northern Exposure. But what saves the Boys of Twilight are the boys themselves. Richard Farnsworth plays the town sheriff, and Wilfred Brimley is the deputy. If you saw Farnsworth in Anne of Green Gables, you know how wonderful he can be. And Brimley in commercials can even make oatmeal sound good. So anytime these guys are on screen, even if it's just to explain something simple to a new city boy deputy, the Boys of Twilight has charm to spare.
There was no country person done this, Bill.
Nope. Why do you say that?
Well, country person don't do things like a city person does. Country person might have took a gun, axe, hammer, something he could get a good hold of, but arsenic, that's a city person. That's doing it with gloves on.
Louise Fletcher co-stars as the sheriff's wife, which is another plus. It's as nice and as rare to see actors of this age and stature get series work as it is to see mountains in the background while they're acting. The Boys of Twilight is worth a look and a chance. Fish Police is a disappointment. And Scorch is the best proof yet that network television, and CBS in particular, is really dragging.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air is produced by Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Thad Kirk, and Audrey Vablaitis. And we welcome back Naomi Person from her travels in the Far East. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
It wasn't until her son died of AIDS that Dorothy Beam discovered a project that her son had been working on, a collection of writings by gay black men. Now she's an AIDS activist, and she's helping to finish the work her son started. Coming up on the next Fresh Air, a talk with Dorothy Beam.